for April 16, 2007, a wonderful Monday afternoon. Thanks for everyone for being here. Members, we have several bills, one, two, three, four, five bills, that I'm going to open a public hearing on all five in order to kind of hear the overlapping testimony that that will take place on these bills. It's not my intention to enter the work session on either any of these bills this afternoon. We are going to be educated on the ins and outs of these bills before deciding whether we'll move forward on any of them. So at this point, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2019, House Bill 3295, House Bill 3343, House Bill 3344, and House Bill 3480. And Representative Hunt is with us, and I'd like to invite him to come forward as our committee administrator explains the bills to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Members, you have before you underneath the agenda the staff measure summaries. I'll briefly describe them. House Bill 2019 authorizes the school district to establish an impact fee on the creation of new residential dwellings, directs public entity administering a building permit program within the school district to assess and collect impact fees before issuing building permit for new residential dwelling unit, authorizes public entity administering the building permit program within the school district to charge a separate fee to recover administrative costs, caps maximum amount of impact fees and system development charges for parks and recreation per dwelling unit. The second bill is House Bill 3295. It establishes the principal residence property tax exemption for local property taxes for the dwelling units of senior citizens and persons with disabilities with a household income of $32,000 or less, with an inflation-linked index linked to the U.S. City Average Consumer Price Index. Applies to local option property taxes approved after January 1st, 2008, and to tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2008. House Bill 3243 authorizes school districts to site a school on attractive land within 3 miles of the urban growth boundary without adopting exception to the statewide land use planning goal. It authorizes the city or district within the county to extend specified urban services to school, notwithstanding statewide land use planning goals relating to public facilities and services. House Bill 3344 allocates from the Department of Administrative Services Economic Development Fund to school capital matching subaccount by which monies in the fund available for the allocation in each biennium exceeds the amount projected to be available for allocation. Declares emergency effective on passage. There's a dash one amendment you have before you that would add the Westside Lottery Bonds and the Lottery Bond Fund to the list of funds that require to be paid before determining excess funds. And lastly, Mr. Chair, we have House Bill 3480, which allows the Department of Education to award grants to school districts for capital costs. It requires capital projects for which grants funds are received to meet energy efficiency standards, continuously appropriates monies in the school capital matching subaccount of the Educational Stability Fund to the Department of Education for grants, allocates money from the Administrative Services Economic Development Fund to school capital matching subaccount, by which monies in the fund available for allocation each biennium is more than 5% greater than the amount projected to be available, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. And, Mr. Chair, all these bills have subsequent referrals, most to Ways and Means, Revenue, and the Land Use Planning one to Ag and Natural Resources. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative Hunt, you have an abundance of ideas. And I would welcome you to start anywhere you like and begin to fill us in.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And I would really say, I think if you think about the ideas that are before you today, they are certainly not my ideas. They are really ideas that, frankly, have been birthed from legislators and constituents and school advocates over a whole series of years as school districts have dealt with, I should say for the record, Representative Thank Dave you. Hunt from Clackamas County, as districts have dealt with really the twin issues of high growth districts needing to deal with rapid expansion of their buildings and the need to have dollars to build those buildings, as well as all districts in the state dealing with greatly aging buildings and the need to repair and renovate those facilities. And some districts are dealing with both. But really, every district is dealing with one or the other. I think the tragedy has been that we as a legislature have seen and come up with lots of good ideas over time, but the getting them to actual fruition has been the challenge. I think that's the hope this session in bringing forward these bills, which have broad bipartisan support, to really, you know, take good ideas and actually pass them into statute. And so the list you have before you, and I realize you have all the bills, you also probably have this sheet, which attempts to summarize several of the bills, in addition to the top two items, which are in other committees, double majority reform, which the House passed 2 weeks ago, and HR 13, which the House Revenue Committee just passed out last week, which deals with allowing the issuance of general obligation bonds to be able to match K-12 capital construction at the local level, an idea that actually Treasurer Edwards came up with several years ago. But the bills that are before you are really additional tools in that same toolbox. Double majority reform is one tool for local districts. HR 13, the geo bonding, is another tool by having some access for the state to be able to bond funds is one tool. But the bills before you, I think, provide a series of other tools for districts to be able to respond to these twin needs. You've got under school impact fees on the orange sheet, you've got House Bill 2019, which provides for a new school impact fee. The local districts could impose on new construction. There are several other versions of this that are in both House and Senate bills. Everything from adding schools to the existing SDCs, so districts could impose a school SDC, all the way to having a school impact fee without any kind of a cap. This imposes a specific cap on the school impact fees, so districts could impose a cap of up to $4,000 for new construction. And in addition to that, this version actually puts a cap on the park portion of SDCs, which many would argue have at least in some districts grown out of control. It does grandfather in the existing ones, but allows others to grow only up to that level. There's also an additional proposal that is in Senate Revenue right now, which would impose an excise tax on construction of all kinds, residential, commercial, industrial, and with some specific caps on the commercial and industrial side of it. I think as you look at House Bill 2019 as one option, as you look at these other options, I just hope we make a commitment that we are going to pass one of these bills this session, that we're not going to let another session go by with lots of good ideas and five people working on this one, and 10 working on this one, and 13 working on this one, and then then we adjourn, sign you die, and school districts are left holding the bag again. I am open to any of them. I have brought one specific one before you in House Bill 2019, which I think makes a lot of sense. But I'm very open. The thing I just think we need to do is actually not let another session go by without taking action. The next item on your list is are related to the direction of lottery funds that accrue beyond the prediction. Basically, the governor budgets a specific amount of lottery proceeds in the governor's budget each biennium. This bill would take the amount of lottery that exceeds that projection and put it specifically for K-12 capital construction. That is obviously not a stable source of funding. That may be very high in some years when the lottery greatly exceeds projections, and it may be very low or nothing in other years. But it's one additional. Again, if you look at these as tools in the toolbox, I think that's one additional tool to put some dollars into that capital account in addition to the dollars that are already scheduled to roll over once the Education Stability Fund fills up. The next, there are actually two versions of that. One is 3344, one is 3480. The major difference between the two, I think, is that 3480 requires that the excess be at least 5% greater than the original projection and also adds some specific energy efficiency standards. Either one of those bills, I think, makes a lot of sense in terms of finding, again, not solving the problem by itself, but finding one additional source of revenue. House Bill 3343, which is the next one on your list, enables school districts to purchase and site schools on land outside of urban growth boundaries. And it has some descriptions in here the intent is really, I mean, obviously the school districts now, especially those school districts which are near the edges of urban growth boundaries, they've really got a lose-lose proposition right now. They can gamble by purchasing land outside the urban growth boundary and hope that it comes in which case they've made a good gamble because they've got property at good value. Or they can wait until the urban growth boundary decisions are made, and then they can no longer afford the land outside the UGB. So we've really put them in a very lose-lose situation, I think. This is not going to be a solution for a large number of districts, but I think there may be a few districts across the state where this provides them an opportunity to site a school facility outside the UGB, as long as it's in close proximity to the UGB and has access to the kind of facilities and infrastructure that would be needed for that school. And the last one on your list is House Bill 3295, which tries to deal with the issue that I think so many of us who have helped to campaign for and pass local school bond measures have dealt with, where you've got seniors living on fixed incomes who will say, absolutely, I support that measure, but there's no way I can take an additional hit on my fixed income as a senior property tax paying person. This bill would allow school districts to exempt senior low income seniors, and there's a test in there that's based on the test we already use for the senior property tax deferral program. Exempt these low income seniors from paying property taxes on that additional increment that a school bond measure would add to their existing property taxes. Wouldn't exempt them out from all their property taxes, just that additional increment. So if you put a bond measure out that's going to be an extra dollar per thousand of assessed value, that low-income senior would be exempted out from that additional increment. And
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
So we're going to try to let them get through their presentation.
And that actually is the last bill, Mr. Chair. I think again the focus here, I think I am open. I think the other sponsors of the bills are completely open to amendments. I think the core goal that I certainly have, I think many of you have, is that we actually use this session to finally get over the bar of moving what have been a lot of good bipartisan ideas across the finish line into statute. So we do give school districts at least a handful of tools that they can begin to use, some of which involves matching funds from the state, some of which involves elections tools, and some of which involves the kind of land use siting that they can utilize to make sure they've got tools to be able to both repair their existing facilities as well as add new facilities as they deal with growth in their districts.
Thank you, Representative. Treasurer Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon. I'm here, and I'm really excited by the fact that we have a list of bills that are going to address, in my view, a continued need in our school system that we have, as the Majority Leader just described. We've talked a lot about the capital needs of our schools, and yet we've done virtually nothing in trying to help local school districts make those investments in their schools. I think the list of bills here really shows the wide-ranging landscape of policy options and financial tools to help accomplish moving the state down the road of making critical investments in our schools. And I've sat in your seat, and I know how important the K through 12 budget is, and that is, of course, focused on operating the schools. Don't want to diminish that. We need to broaden this discussion and find solutions to that bigger question. And in my mind, operating a school is maintaining and building schools themselves. We'd all like to see things like smaller class sizes. That will have a capital impact on schools. Not every school district can accommodate smaller class sizes. Modernization. If you're in a fast-growing district, you're trying to accommodate a growing population. I think that last bill, or second-to-last bill, about building outside the UGB. Again, a problem for fast-growing districts. How do they not only have the land, but how do they afford to build and then have people in these schools? So those questions equally of importance. In 2001, the Secretary of State's office actually did an audit of the capital situation of our schools. We have about $9 billion invested in our K-12 system in schools. Their report came out, and I'd be happy to share that with you, showed, and then again in 2001, well over $2 billion in needs of modernization and maintenance, deferred maintenance. Having said that, certainly times passed and those costs have risen, and sure, some bond measures have passed, but one can assume that those numbers continue to grow. There are numerous lists upon lists, and I know those on this committee know what those problems and challenges are in just making sure that our schools are safe. It's not only making sure that we have a quality education occurring, but that our students are safe and that they're meeting the needs of that local school district.
Well,
this problem, as I said, is getting worse and not better. We do need to find some solutions. Other states have state involvement in helping their school districts meet their capital needs. Oregon does not, and we need to step up and make those changes. Like Representative Hunt, these are ideas. These are ideas that need to be worked, but I would submit they are ideas that have been vetted for a number of months, and I want to give credit to Representative Hunt. He has had a work group working on these ideas and others. This is the list and partial of what has been discussed. It's been bipartisan. My office has been involved. It is something that, again, I encourage you to step forward, find something here that can move the ball forward, because as Dave said, we are going to see eventually in the next couple, 3 years, the Education Stability Fund will cap, and out of that begins the filling of a school capital matching grant, which again, we need to move forward to meet that need, not only now, but in the future. And I would say, please take this as an opportunity to move forward and take this as an opportunity to take these ideas, vet them, but find something to help move this debate forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. Representative Greenland.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I love all these ideas. And we do need to move forward. I have a question on 3295. I'm sitting on a work group, with Representative Clemmon, on land use and annexation, and there was a proposition in the annexation that would allow the exemption of some people from property taxes for a certain period after their land was annexed. And the ledge council told us that that was unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. It treats certain citizens different for tax purposes than others. And I wonder whether 3295 is going to run into that same problem, treating seniors with less income differently than juniors with less income and people with less income.
Public officials with less.
Junior. I'm a senior, so everybody else is. I think it's just something that we may need to check on that.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlick. I don't believe we got anything back. I did submit a couple other bills this session where I got back the letter. But I don't believe one came here, and part of it is if you look at what we already base the senior property tax deferral program, we actually have some property tax exemption programs for veterans and troops and their families that we passed last session.
Sure.
That and actually the economic criteria standard that is utilized in this bill is almost exactly identical to what's utilized in those two cases. So I think the standard they may be talking about in terms of annexation is treating two people who may be financially identical but geographically separated. That may be the issue in terms of difference. But certainly we treat people of different means differently in statute and property taxes already. So I'll be happy to follow up on that.
All right. I was sort of shocked to get that answer.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions? Representative Crummell.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a question of you.
Right.
I have questions on just about all of these bills. And do you prefer to hear all the testimony first? Because I don't know who's going to be best equipped to answer my questions. Maybe the two gentlemen that are currently sitting at the table, maybe. But then again, maybe not.
You can take your pick here, Representative. We've got a wide variety of people signed up. But since Representative Hunt has been at the center of the work group, he is as good a place to start as any.
All right. So with your indulgence.
Please.
Starting on House Bill 2019. It appears as though well, first of all, I think there's a typo on page 2, line 18, ORS 233.304 sub 6.
Representative Cummings, can you quote the line again? I'm sorry.
Page 2, line 18, ORS 233.304, sub 6. I couldn't find it anywhere in the statutes. And I mean, I realize that I'm challenged in a lot of ways, but number sequence seems to be okay with me.
That's different.
And maybe it was just my copy of the statutes. But
we have given you a special copy.
yeah, that's what I'm concerned about. on page 1 of 2019, lines 11 to 15, 11 to 14, is that kind of the test? In terms of what the money is going to be used for, as to then determining whether or not the school district can actually levy the impact fee.
In terms of the definition of capital improvement,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, yes, that is the intent, to have it. If other members of the committee don't have that language in front of them, related to acquisition of land, construction or reconstruction, renovation or improvement of school facilities, acquisition or installation of new technology, or other capital expenditures that improve the school district's ability to educate students. The goal is to both define what it is, but also in the next line to define what it is not. So these dollars, you know, school districts would not have access to state money or would not have access to bond money to then put it over into the operational side, to keep that line of demarcation that is there and should stay there.
I'm not sure what other capital is reserved for expansion. It's not there.
It's not there.
So anyway, okay, I'll move on. On page 2, line 16 through 18, where we found that little typo, I have a feeling it's supposed to be 223, not 233. But anyway, what does that mean? Says an impact fee collected by a school district under this section may not exceed the difference between $8,000 per dwelling unit and the amount collected for a system development charge for parks and recreation under ORS 233.304 sub 6.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, the way this bill is structured, because it does both allow a school impact fee and cap parks SDCs, it does make it a little more confusing than a bill that just would straight do one or the other. The intent there, and I believe what the language does, is to say a school district already had a $3,000 park SDC. They could therefore let's say they had a $4,000 park SDC. That means they could add a $4,000 school impact fee for a total cap of $8,000. And maybe the better example I should give is if they already have, because there are a few districts that you may know well that are already higher than that in terms of park SDCs.
Right.
If they already have a $4,500 park SDC, that would limit their ability to add a school impact fee to $3,500. So you keep, as the one rises, you keep the cap, the total cap in there regardless.
Okay. Still on page 2 at line... at line 32, it says may establish and collect an additional fee in the amount of 1%. So what we're going to do is we're going to allow the cities to collect a fee of 1% for their administrative costs of collecting the fee and passing it on to the school district. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I am trying to figure out if that applies. Does that apply to the taxing authority, or does that apply to the school district?
If the read-in line is at 9 on line 27, the official responsible for administering the public entity's public building permit program under ORS Chapter 455, and then you drop down to B, may establish and collect an additional fee in an amount that does not exceed 1% of the amount of the impact fee intended to recover the cost of the public entity to assess and collect the impact fee pursuant to subsection 8 of this section. The way I read that is that, so if you've got the city, if I've got the city of Wilsonville that is collecting the fee for the Westland Wilsonville schools, they can charge the school district 1%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, that I think that would be a fair reading of that provision.
So on $3,500, 1% is going to be $35.
Mm-hmm.
That may not even come close to covering their costs. I'm just
Mr. Chairman,
that out there.
I think that's a good observation. I would certainly be very open to any changes there. I frankly can't even remember where that 1% figure came from. It may be based on something else that's already in statute in terms of another provision, and LC may have plugged that in there.
I know other places in the statute there's a 5% limitation, but almost sounds like it was a PFA.
Representative, I was passed a note by Representative Hutt's staff that he's being called to testify in another committee as well.
Okay.
Would it be possible to come back after you testify there? If it fits with your schedule, we'd love to keep hitting you with questions. Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Sorry for the interruption, but the staff is cringing there on the side of the room, but he's over obligated at the moment.
Can I ask one more question, and then I'd be done with that, Bill?
Very good, Bill.
Real quickly, so on page 4, basically, as you described it, we're going to cap Parcast DC on the city at $4,000. We're going to cap the school's impact fee at $4,000 for a maximum of $8,000, as it's in the journal of whatever it is, engineering or something. So what we're going to do is that in order to put this in place, we're going to limit the city's ability to provide parks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, that would be one way of portraying it.
Okay, I just want to make sure I understand it correctly.
I think one of the challenges obviously out there, those who are on the paying end of the SDCs or the school impact fees, I think their concern has been, obviously currently under SDCs there are not specific caps, whether it's roads, sewer, water, parks. There are not specific caps that apply. They have they have a methodology they have to come up with. I think the goal of this is to, as I have heard concerns raised about that by those paying those fees, it's been particularly in the area of parks. I haven't heard much concerns about, you know, road fees or sewer water fees getting too high on the SDC side. But I think I certainly have heard that related to parks. And the attempt of this bill is to address that concern, which is out there, while at the same time enabling local school districts to be able to add some additional capacity for schools. There are very few districts in the state, less than a handful, that are above the $4,000 cap currently. As the bill's constructed, they would be grandfathered in. They would not be capped back down. They would be grandfathered in. And the $4,000 the total of $8,000 amount would then grow with an inflation adjustment factor over time. But it is a balancing act, no question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
I have one small question.
If it's quick, it has to be a real quick question.
Very quick.
Right.
And thank you very much. In the bill, it's talking about the unit or units. Can you define what the unit means? It means one single house or in the apartment 10 units in there, is that 10 units? What's the definition on that? Because $8,000 per unit.
That is an excellent question, Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, and I do not know the answer. But I'd be happy to get back to you, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hunt. Thank you for bringing the ideas forward for our discussion. Thank you, Treasurer. I appreciate your time very much. Committee members, since we are on to focusing on 2019, we'll just continue going in this direction with, we'll call two more proponents, Gary Conklin and Dana Hepler, for 2019. We do have a good number of members of the public who would like to talk on the bills. We won't be going into work session on any of these, so
I'll hold on to my questions there, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate it. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gary Conklin, appearing here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We're in support of House Bill 2019, which would allow a school district to impose a school impact fee on both single and multifamily residential development. AGC members, for those of you who don't know, are commercial builders, which includes contractors who build multifamily housing. So we're here today talking about something that would affect our members who build multifamily housing. We support a school impact fee because we believe a nexus exists between residential construction and the expansion of school facility capacity. The school impact fee is a fee that can be linked fairly closely to a residential unit square footage or number of bedrooms. There can be a methodology that can connect the two. School demographers have the ability to estimate fairly accurately the potential student enrollment from different kinds of residential development. And from that data, they can also determine where new school sites are needed. In fact, based on my prior experience representing the Beaverton School District, that's exactly what they did. A school impact fee can generate the revenue to enable those districts, as has been noted, to buy school sites or to make other capital improvements. School impact fees have the quality of generating revenue from residential construction in the community where school enrollment is expanding, and in many cases, and largely from the residential development that creates the demand for new or expanded school facilities. AGC believes the school impact fee is the fairest, most reliable tool to help schools in meeting the challenge of siting and building new schools, as well as expanding and renovating existing ones. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Scott.
Hi. For the record, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm the statewide advocacy coordinator with Stand for Children. And I'm just really thrilled that we're having this hearing today focusing on school facilities, and thrilled that Dave Hunt has brought these bills forward. I'm a former third grade teacher, and I taught at a overcrowded school in a portable classroom at a building that also was aging and had facilities needs on that end. So I am just thrilled that we're looking to address some of these problems, because I know Little Lot Whitcomb and North Clackamas School District isn't alone in their needs. Stand for Children's 4,000 members have been working on school facilities issues for quite some time through passing local bonds, pushing statewide legislation last session and this session, and even looking into a statewide ballot measure. And it's clear why they've been doing this. I mean, our school districts across the state are in a pretty bad state when it comes to their facilities needs. Overcrowding means that students are standing in classes, sitting on windowsills and vents, spending their days in portables, small rooms detached from the buildings, often without running water or restrooms. It means some students are eating lunch at 10:20 in the morning so they can siphon all the kids through the cafeteria by 1:30. See the teachers on the committee nodding their heads, right? This isn't anything new. So specifically with regard to the bills that we're talking about today, Stand for Children would like to take a position on two of the bills. And the first bill is House Bill 3480, which is the bill that would basically take extra lottery dollars and put them into the capital sub-account. And we're really excited about this bill because we worked with a lot of the other folks in the room to lower the commission rates that were going to lottery retailers. We were sending about 30-some percent of our lottery dollars back to the retailers, and that was just exceedingly high compared to other states and Canadian provinces that have lottery as a source of revenue. And over 200 Stand for Children members turned out to a lottery commission hearing to testify on the fact that more of our lottery dollars need to be going to our schools. And we're really excited when the lottery commission decided to lower retailer rates. And when they did that, they also put in a provision that triggered an even further rate decrease when the line games were implemented. And if lottery retailers saw a huge increase in revenue then, their rates would kick down even further. So they still saw an additional profit, but not as big of a windfall as they would get had we not lowered the rates again. So that's triggered. And we're really excited that's triggered, and it gives us a little bit of extra wiggle room this session. And so we think, I know our members are really excited to use that money and to invest in our school capital, which has been sorely overlooked as we've, you know, cut school days and teachers over the past 15, 20 years in the state. We would like to see this happen as a one-time investment so that it's not a constitutional ongoing source of revenue for the school capital fund, but we'd really encourage you to stick the excess lottery dollars in the capital sub-account this time. Let's get us all familiar with the capital sub-account. Let's get it defined. Let's attach energy efficiency standards so we ensure we use that money wisely. And then let's look for dedicated revenue sources in the future. I think as we think about our school facilities needs, we can look to Washington State, and they have, as Representative Hunt was talking about, kind of a toolbox of things for school districts to use, and their toolbox includes a statewide capital account for schools that has dedicated revenue sources as well as general fund dollars. They have a they have impact fees for schools that local communities charge, and they have local bonds. And so that's, I think, what we need to be striving toward in Oregon. And I think a one-time allocation to the capital sub-account is a good start in that direction. We also like parts of House Bill 2019, which is the impact fees for schools bill. We're concerned about the connection to parks. We think the combined park schools fees still has a lot of unresolved challenges when it comes to implementation. Parks districts and school districts do not easily align. So the Salem-Keizer school district, for example, that we're sitting in here overlaps four separate parks districts. And so which parks district are we comparing the $8,000 with? And it just becomes complicated when you actually start to apply it on the ground, and we're concerned about that. And we're also, right now, we see parks districts and school districts working pretty well together to co-site facilities when they can and when it's appropriate. And I would hate to see that positive working relationship disintegrate when districts started fighting for what seemed like an inadequate pool of money already. So we would like 2019, if it were amended, to remove the connection to parks, and we're just at an own standalone capped impact fee. And I think that's all I have, so thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, sir. Any questions of these folks here? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. Mr. Conklin, I think you know that I've worked and I've both sessions trying to help in my district provide construction cost. You made a statement about the fact that there's study that new development equals demand on school systems. Could you provide me or tell me how that works in Sun River or rural Deschutes County as far as new construction equaling demand on students compared to a district like Beaverton?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnett, I didn't indicate that there was a study, but in school districts that have demographers, they're able to do a fairly good job of assessing what kind of student population their housing drives. And I appreciate Sun River is a very different kind of a community, just like if you looked at the number of units in an assisted housing facility, you aren't going to find too many students coming from there either. But the point is, I think a school impact fee does permit, and in fact relies on, a fairly rigorous as well as reliable methodology that can connect in a particular community the student population that drives from housing types that are the ones being developed. And again, my familiarity comes from Beaverton. Both as a citizen, I sat on the Long Range School Facility Committee, so I've been in virtually every school facility that Beaverton either built some time ago or is still thinking about building. I've been in a couple of them, including the principal's offices, because two of my children have gone to. I'm very familiar with that particular part of the facilities. But the truth of the matter is that they do a good job of understanding where the kids come from in their community. And if they are off sometimes, they make those adjustments. For the very real reason is that they have to build the schools more or less nearby where the kids are from.
Thank you. Ms. Heffer, you talked about you're in favor of disconnecting the park and recs to the impact fee. And Ben Lapine, you have part of Ben Lapine has a park and recs fee. Part of Ben Lapine does not have a park fee. So with this bill, because you're on the committee, can the ones that aren't park and rec could pay $8,000 and the other ones pay $4,000, or how does that?
That's one of our concerns, is I think when it comes down to the implementation, there are a lot of details that aren't worked out, and it's unclear how much a school district could charge when you connect it to parks. We think lowering the cap, if need be, And disconnecting it from parks would just be a clearer law for school districts to implement.
Thank you. Agreement.
Yes, thank you, sir. I just want to be clear on Stand for Children's stand on this, since we're about 2 weeks away from the deadline on voting on House bills. Do I understand you'll oppose 2019 in its current form?
We have taken a position in opposition to Senate Bill 45, which is a similar bill. Our membership hasn't had a chance to look at 2019 yet, but we know that we would support it if it were disconnected from
But that's not the question. The question is, if we don't have time to disconnect it or don't disconnect it, will you oppose it?
We haven't taken a position yet.
Let me follow one more.
The
bill you oppose is very similar to this?
Yes.
So you oppose the ability to get money for schools if it's tied to parks, as opposed to not getting money for schools?
We would like a capped school impact fee that's separate than parks. We think this is bad public policy and would likely oppose it.
Hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Ms. Sepp, for your testimony.
Yeah.
Representative Kremel, do you have some? Ms. Sepp, I think you...
Actually, since she opposes it, then maybe I don't have a... But I would imagine that the League of Cities will have a...
We do have a representative from League of Cities here.
We'll support it with amendments.
I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, and maybe somebody can answer this as they come up, and that is, how much are we looking at for a school district and statewide, for that matter, to be able to raise through this mechanism?
Any response?
We've just been looking at that for Senate Bill 366, which is basically the first part of 2019, the impact fee part, without changing the parks SDC law. And statewide initial estimates were guessing between $75 and $98 million at the state level. And then we've just started to break it down for local communities. I was looking at unincorporated Clackamas County this morning, and we thought that a $4,000 capped impact fee could raise like $2.6 million a year in unincorporated Clackamas County, which is where a lot of that growth is going on in Clackamas County.
Thank you. Representative Dolan.
And should be able to get you better numbers by the end of the week.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Dolan.
The implication is that you've done that for districts across the state?
We're working on collecting estimates on what impact fees could raise in 9 counties. So that would, I think we're looking at Jackson County, Marion County, Polk County, Washington, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Deschutes. And I may not have named 9 there yet.
Representative Dom represents 9 counties, I believe.
I do represent 9 counties, and I did not hear a very small part of Deschutes. I did not hear very much about Eastern Oregon, and I would like to see the impact Wheeler County and Sherman County. I'd like to see that.
Chair Buckley, Representative Dallum, we'll certainly get you what we have, but also we definitely recognize that none of the tools that we're presenting today or any other day solve the diverse array of facility needs across the state, and that's why we think we need a state school capital fund. We think we need general obligation bonding for schools, and we think we need some local tools around planning choices that positively impact schools, and we think we need some local tools for raising revenue beyond just the bond, so some kind of impact fee type of tool. And we think with that spectrum of tools that we can meet the needs of most of the districts in the state, including the districts in Wheeler and Sherman County like you're talking about.
I don't see them here right now, but I'm sure I will.
Right. I think geo-bonding and even this capital sub-account 3480, I think both of those could be targeted to those low property value per student districts that really have a difficult time raising the local revenue to build and renovate their schools.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks.
Mr. Olson, would you call our next panel, please?
Yes. Can Daniel Eisenbeiss and John Charles and Amanda Rich please come up to the stand?
If you'd be so kind to start with the House Bill 2019, your comments on that, and if you have comments on the other bills, you'd be welcome to make those as well.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, my name is Daniel Eisenbeiss, Legislative Affairs Director for 1000 Friends of Oregon. I would like to comment today on House Bill 2019 as well as House Bill 3343. 1000 Friends of Oregon strongly supports authorizing communities to charge a school impact fee on new residential development. However, we cannot support House Bill 2019 as drafted because the proposal limits the amount of already allowed SDCs for parks and recreation. Capping locally adopted residential development fees for parks because a new fee would also be allowed for schools confuses the distinct roles of these two vital elements of community infrastructure. Schools and parks are both necessary infrastructure for a livable community. Though both educational and recreational services are provided at some school and park facilities, certain types of educational facilities are found only at schools, not at parks. Likewise, the variety of park and recreation infrastructure in communities extends well beyond that associated with schools, and sometimes the recreational facilities found at school sites are not publicly available. That is why these kinds of infrastructure are distinct, and it would not be wise public policy to cap one because of the existence of the other as proposed in House Bill 2019. Schools and parks cannot come at the expense of one another. It must be respected as distinct in Oregon's efforts to make sure communities are able to adequately charge for infrastructure costs associated with development. This bill would also place a cap on school impact fees at $8,000 per new dwelling unit. While we prefer no such cap, we are supportive of the school impact fee portion of the bill as a first step toward ensuring that all community infrastructure needs are met. And on that point, let me just note that these fees only cover a portion of the cost of infrastructure associated with development. We're not talking about putting the full cost on the new residents of these growing areas. 1000 Friends of Oregon urges you to amend this proposal to remove the cap on park and recreation facilities. And Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I could move on to 3343.
Why don't you? You're on a roll.
In short, we believe that House Bill 3343 is a solution in search of a problem. It is true that some school districts are facing serious issues in funding and siting new schools to accommodate a growing population. School siting, school population forecasting, land use planning, transportation planning, and school financing need to be better coordinated. Moreover, school districts need state support for construction of school facilities. However, this proposal is not the answer to school district needs for school sites. Existing law already provides several ways in which a school may be sited outside an urban growth boundary if, in fact, there are no available sites within the UGB. First, the UGB can be expanded to include land sufficient for the school site. Current statute is very clear that if there is not land available within a UGB for school sites, that alone is reason enough to expand the urban growth boundary. Second, a school district may seek a, quote, reasons exception to the EFU zone. That is, if they can show that they have a good reason for locating the school on EFU land outside the UGB and other sites which do not require an exception to the EFU zone are not available, the school district can site a new school on EFU land, also covered by current statute. And third, schools can be located on EFU land which is not high value and is located at least 3 miles beyond the urban growth boundary. The reasons for keeping urban schools within urban growth boundaries and rural schools beyond urban growth boundaries in rural areas are plenty. The siting of a school and making sure that there are safe routes to that school, that it's accessible for kids to walk and bike to school, is part of what makes communities complete, what makes neighborhoods strong. Proponents argue that land is cheaper outside the urban growth boundary. Well, that is true in raw terms, but such an argument could be made for siting just about any facility with a public benefit outside of urban growth boundaries, such as hospitals, fire stations, police stations, you name it. If school funding is the problem, scapegoating our land use system should not be the answer. Schools are also magnets for development, and this particular proposal would allow urban infrastructure such as sewer and water to be extended to school sites. That inevitably increases the pressure for intensified development along these lines, which would challenge well-planned communities down the road. School districts often, understandably, become focused on the cost of constructing a new school without too much attention to the associated costs that may fall on other jurisdictions. For instance, right now, the formula by which the state reimburses local school districts for transportation costs does not reward those school districts that make more efficient use of land use patterns. So when we cite urban schools in rural areas, we increase the transportation costs, but it's not necessarily the local school district that is paying for that. Meanwhile, we are introducing new conflicts in agricultural zones. This session is actually a perfect example of the kinds of conflicts that arise. There was a very similar bill before the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee, 2465, if I remember correctly, that would have been restricted to just Hood River. Meanwhile, we've seen a bill introduced, Senate Bill 20, that would restrict agricultural spraying near schools. And I understand that that particular proposal was very contentious in the same Hood River Valley. We should seek to avoid such conflicts in the future, not have to create them and then try and undo them. Thank you for your consideration of our comments.
Thank you very much. Members, we will reflect once we hear from all three of our panelists. Ms. Rich, for who's ever next.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute, a Portland-based research center. I'd just like to address a couple potential unintended consequences from this bill. First is, I suppose it's obvious, this is a tax on new housing, and so it will artificially increase the value of existing housing but dampen the supply of new construction. So this is likely to worsen what is already a bad problem of a lack of affordable housing throughout the state. Second, low-income housing units are exempt from this fee, lines 7 and 8 of page 2. So this will incentivize developers to build more multifamily housing projects for low-income families, especially if you're in a school district that opts into this program, surrounded by school districts that don't opt into it. That school district would likely be a place that there would be many low-income housing projects built. The result would be an increased number of students in that district and no impact fee revenue from those projects, which might not be the outcome that the local school district really desires. Third point is lines 23-24, page 2, appear to exempt new subdivisions explicitly established as age-restricted neighborhoods with no kids allowed. Now, this is one of the fastest-growing trends nationwide anyway, incentivized by local government officials who are thrilled with the idea of thousands of, in some places, thousands of homes built that are de-restricted to be age 48 or 55 and above. They get property tax revenue, and they don't have to provide any school services. So, and as I read this section, it's possible, since the revenue can only be spent on facilities required to service the new homes, and if the developer shows that the new homes, by definition, would have no school-age kids, well, if no revenue is collected, then you have age-restricted homes here, and disproportionate number of low-income housing projects here with lots of kids and no fee revenue. Again, I don't think that's really an outcome that the proponents of the bill wanted, and it may actually lead to school districts simply not opting into this program, which means it doesn't really do anything. So I think there are other ways to approach this particular issue, which I won't get into today because they're beyond the scope of the bill, but I think you should read some of the definition sections and the sections I stated in my testimony very carefully to imagine what the potential unintended consequences of this bill might be. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. Could you clarify which section of the bill that, of 2019 you're referring to? in reference to the senior housing? Or
That was my third point. Lines 22, 23, 24, page 2, says a school district may use monies collected as an impact fee only to pay for capital improvements to school facilities that are needed to meet the demands placed on the facilities by the new residential dwelling units.
Thank you.
Okay. And my parents have lived in those types of developments for the last 30 years. And,
Thank you, Mr. Charles. I appreciate it. Ms. Rich.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, my name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Recreation and Park Association and also the Special Districts Association of Oregon. And we are here today in, sounds like I have like three people living in my head, but I am here today in opposition to House Bill 2019. It sometimes feels like that. Yeah. We are opposed to House Bill 2019. However, please do not read that opposition as opposition to a school impact fee, school development fee, school SDC, whatever it is that you want to call it. We are very supportive behalf of our school partners of a school development fee. I think that it's important. In fact, we've talked a little bit, you've heard a little bit about the partnerships that recreation agencies have with school districts, and across the state you'll see incredible examples of these kind of partnerships. One that I like to talk about is in the area served by Tualatin Hills Parks and Recreation Department, the school district has zero pools, and the THPRD has seven pools. Now, those kids swim, and they have swimming programs, and it's because of an intergovernmental agreement between THPRD and the school districts, and SDCs were used in the construction of some of those pools. And again, it's just a great example of how these facilities across the state have worked together to make every dime go as far as possible. And I would really hate to see a bill like this come along that, in essence, pits them against each other in a struggle for revenues, and to see some of the a degradation of some of those relationships and some of those kind of smart ways of doing business that we're seeing around the state. You heard Dana talk about the administration issues and, you know, how do we figure out in overlapping districts where the cap applies and who the cap applies to, so I won't belabor that. But I would like to talk just briefly about the issue of what is, in essence, an arbitrary cap on a fee that is intended to capture the costs of growth. And my members are adamantly opposed to caps on SDCs or development fees, and believe it's not that they believe that they should just be as high as possible. They believe that the fee should be reflective of the methodology and a local conversation about the needs of the community, what level of service they would like to see, and a conversation also with the developers about what they are willing to pay for and what the community is willing to support. And that includes what this body believes should be included in those SDC methodologies, that you are also a part of this conversation in terms of what types of costs go into the methodology that builds a fee, and then from there it goes on to the local conversation about what level of service they want and how they're going to fund those services. So I guess I'm here today asking for you to oppose House Bill 2019 to the extent that it puts a cap on park SDCs and also essentially combines parks and schools under one cap. I would like to bring your attention to I've passed out a packet of resolutions from agencies across the state, both cities and park districts. And they are just asking that you allow them to maintain local control over their decisions in terms of their park development fees. That's all I have to say, unless there are any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. From Senator Bonamici, would you care to join us and weigh in?
Thank you very much, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. I'm Suzanne Bonamici, State Representative for House District 34 in Washington County, and I'm also wearing the hat today of a parent of a student in the Beaverton School District, where I've been a parent for the past 13 years. Thank you so much for hearing these bills today. I want to talk just very briefly about the big picture. I know that you are very aware of the need in areas that are high growth, like Beaverton School District, which is, to my understanding, the fastest growing district in the state. I told you when I was here to testify about the system development charge bill that I co-sponsored about some of the issues that have arisen in, for example, my daughter's school, where she has classrooms in half of a portable. They have no lockers in their school because there's no room for lockers. We have elementary schools with no kindergartens because there's no room for the kindergarten, so they have to bus kindergarten schools to fields full of portables. It's a very serious need. It has been a need for several years. And so, again, my appreciation for hearing these bills. I wanted to just talk briefly about agreeing with a couple of the comments that have been made in the past testimony, particularly with House Bill 2019. I agree that it's very important to have some way to fund capital constructions, but I also agree that it's not appropriate to pit schools against parks. That is a great concern of mine. I know that the Beaverton School District has worked cooperatively with Tualatin Hills Parks and Rec. I don't want to see those entities fighting for the same dollars. I think that they've had a lot of cooperative arrangements, and I think that passing this bill that would cap their fees would interfere with that working relationship. And I just don't think it's good policy to have the capped park and school impact fee in the same bill. I'm also going to agree with Ms. Rich's testimony about the cap. Ideally, I would like to see no cap because I think that the districts work very hard to make sure that they are only setting forth the needs that they have. I've seen that again and again working on bond measures. The district does a very good job of assessing the need and being very realistic about what's appropriate to ask for their construction costs. Now, I know we're in the House and we like bills that start with H. However, there are a couple of great Senate bills that address these issues that I'd like you to keep an open mind about, including Senate Bill 366, which is the school impact fee that only addresses schools and doesn't the schools against the parks. And also keep an open mind about Senate Bill 1036, which is the construction excise tax. Those are both bills that are being worked on the Senate side that address this issue. I don't know if there's one over the other that's going to be coming our way, but please keep an open mind about those proposals in addition to everything that you're hearing today. So again, thank you very much for addressing this very important issue both as a representative and as a parent. I appreciate your bringing these issues forward.
Thank you, Representative.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you again.
Thank you so much. Mr. Olson.
Martha Pellegrino and Andy Shaw, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino from the city of Portland. I am here today to testify in opposition to 2019, but for the reasons that have primarily already been stated, I would just like to add my voice to the chorus in that we definitely see a huge need for a solution here, and that there are a number of schools around the state that desperately need to meet capital needs. So we appreciate the fact this committee is working very hard and looking at these solutions. I would briefly like to make one point on economic benefit that I don't believe has been made yet today, and that is, while I understand and we heard earlier that there are folks who get sticker shock when they see an increase in a school impact fee, I would also like to say that, or the benefit that they receive from a well-functioning, well-planned park system and schools certainly increases the value of the property much more than I think that any single impact fee would. So I think that we want to see a system that recognizes those benefits as well. In terms of the administrability point that was made earlier, Portland has actually 5 school districts, either in whole or in part. That creates a special challenge. Reynolds School District also encompasses Fairview, Wood Village, and Gresham, which makes it a little also very difficult to figure out how this calculation might work. And lastly, I would just like to say that the partnership, the longstanding partnership that the City of Portland has had with Portland Public Schools, is one that we would like to preserve and encourage. We provide after-school programs. We provide maintenance to school facilities. A proposal that would pit schools against parks would certainly harm that partnership. So I appreciate the committee's time and consideration of these very important bills. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Shaw.
Good afternoon. Andy Shaw with the League of Cities. Cities are very supportive of the discussion around trying to identify an infrastructure financing solution. Cities also have numerous infrastructure needs locally, so we understand the strong desire to find local solutions that address the impacts of growth. We're very concerned, though, about the evolving discussion this year around school finance, which generally has been trying to find a way to give a tool to school districts with a trade-off of taking away a tool from cities, counties, and other local districts. 2019 is one example of that. The discussion that's occurring on the Senate side was mentioned earlier, and Senate Bill 1036 is another example of that. It would raise an excise, or allow school districts to establish an excise tax to fund school infrastructure, which is appearing to be a very good mechanism. But the trade-off there would be to preempt cities' ability to raise an excise tax, which is an authority the cities have now that's unfettered. SDCs are based on a methodology that's related to impact, so we don't see a good reason to cap SDCs, and excise taxes that cities use now are used to fund other operating and infrastructure needs that are often related to the impacts of growth. Often cities do not charge the full allowable cost under an SDC, recognizing the balance between funding local infrastructure needs and an effort to accommodate growth and try to meet some balance locally. So we would share many of the concerns that you've heard earlier about local partnerships and not interrupting those and not creating arbitrary caps when the methodology suits just fine. So I'll leave it at that for now and be available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Seeing no questions or questions?
May I ask
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Martha, I was just wondering, aren't there some areas in Portland where there are actually parks co-located with schools?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, yes, that's correct, that we have sited, there are parks that are sited near schools, or adjacent to schools.
And if I may, Mr. Well. Chair, so how does that work? Because I did a trip around the country last summer and saw a variety of places where this was actually going on, where schools and parks were being kind of co-located, and of course part of the park became the school ground during the school day. And I was just wondering how that works. One that I know of in particular also has a pool attached to it over in Northwest Portland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I believe that's correct. I actually can't sort of name that site for you, but it is true that there are parks that are located adjacent to schools that school children have the ability to use during the day.
That site in Northwest Portland's MLC.
in the city of Ashland, Walker Elementary School. You're welcome to come down and visit.
Play on the swings.
Play on the swings.
Play on the swings.
All right.
Absolutely. I like that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilson.
John Chandler.
Chandler. Sorry.
That's right. Mr. Chandler, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of several bills, opposition to another bill, and a reminder that there are more bills coming your direction, which we think address the problem much better. Although with regard to House Bill 2019, Mr. Chairman, it's similar to the conversation we used to have growing up, would you rather be electrocuted or beheaded? If we had to live with an impact fee for schools, 2019 would be our preference because of the combination with parks. Should the bill get traction, I'd go into more detail with the chair's permission. We do prefer and have been working very hard on Senate Bill 1036, which you've already heard about over on the Senate side, would be the construction excise tax, a method that we believe would be much more fair and more dependable way to fund schools through the new construction. With regard to 2019, though, the reason parks and schools are listed together is not merely an attempt to torture two different agencies at once, but because there is a connection. As has been observed by Representative Crummell, oftentimes parks and schools are co-located. Oftentimes they are not. Sometimes the school land, which looks like a park, functions like a park, has ball teams on it like a park, has picnics on it like a park, is not counted by the local jurisdiction as a park because it's not theirs, it's the school district's. There's a variety of things like that that when we're asked to help pay for things, we'd like to see them used efficiently. If our money is being used for roads or sewer or water or transportation or anything else, we'd like to make sure those funds through system development charges are used efficiently. It's our belief that with regard to parks in particular, they often are not. Of the various types of infrastructure that are available for funding in Oregon through an SDC, a system development charge, parks are far and away the area where we have the most collisions with local government and park districts. And that's not because they're meaner and ornerier with regard to parks, it's simply because it's a difficult one to quantify. There are engineering standards for roads, water, sewer. There are no engineering standards for parks. It is a community choice, but as with all community choices that don't have some mathematical or scientific basis behind them, it can be how high is up, and in some jurisdictions, how high is amounts to over $8,000 per house. Since the total SEC burden in Oregon in many jurisdictions is approaching or exceeding $20,000, we like to do what we can to control that for affordable housing purposes and other things. We think 2019, if 1036 does not move, would be the preferable option. Then the if is critical, Mr. Chairman. I'm here in opposition to 2019 today because I believe 1036 will move. I think it has a lot of support. I think, as one of the previous witnesses said, we have been running numbers trying to figure out exactly what we raised under the various scenarios, which is, by the way, harder to do than you would think. And I'll use this opportunity to put in a shameless plug for somebody somewhere getting that data together, whether it be Portland State like they used to or someone. What's happening now is we've hamstrung Legislative Revenue Office with bad data. They're using Census Bureau data interpreted through three sets of filters and a cloud of smoke, as near as I can tell. It's not their fault. But we used to do that at the state level. We do not. In any event, just trying to figure out how much money an SDC on housing would raise by taking building permits times a number has proved very difficult because we don't know how many building permits were issued without calling every jurisdiction in the state to find that number out. We are doing that kind of analysis on the Senate side with regard to 1036. I won't testify any further on a bill that's not even in this chamber, much less in front of this committee. But 2019, should that bill not progress, would be the one we'd like to have a conversation about. With regard to the others, Mr. Chairman, 3343, we have supported in some other version for many years, forcing schools or for that matter any other form of public infrastructure to pay retail for land makes no sense to the extent that we can, certain land use laws aren't the problem with school location exclusively, but to the extent that they are on occasion, some relaxation of those laws, I believe, is in order. We supported 3343, as I say previously. We do so again. With regard to the other two dealing with public finance, they've always prohibited me from dealing with public finance in this process, so I can't speak to the details, but they look like dandy ideas to me. That's a technical term, of course.
That's it. Get that defined.
Be glad to take any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the content and the speed of your testimony. Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, do you prefer that Senate bill because of the preemption?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, that's part of it, yes. I will mention in terms of the preemption, again, with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, since the bill hasn't left that into the building, there are only four cities using that tactic at this moment. So they would be grandfathered in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dahlem, I'm sorry for skipping over you.
Mr. Chandler, I would be rude to ask you anything about Senate Bill 1036, so I will ask you what House Bill 2019 doesn't do. Does 2019 levy a fee on all construction or just housing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dahlem, as I read it, it's just on housing. Residential.
And if the Senate bill were here, would you give me the same answer?
No, sir.
And what kind of fees is it levy? Not wanting to talk about it myself.
What we've talked about, Representative Dahlem, is a fee based on square footage. To be determined yet. The numbers we've been using just for working purposes have been $1 a foot for residential, 50 cents for commercial, 2 bits for industrial, with a cap available to commercial industrial development of a yet to be determined number, hypothetically, of course.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lim.
Thank you very much, John. Why, I'm not sure why they don't charge the school impact fee on the commercial development instead of just residential only.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lim, your question is why wouldn't we extend the impact fee to commercial industrial? Assuming that we are going to be supportive of a school impact fee, we would be supportive of that as well. Hypothetically, again, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If we could charge it in Idaho, we'd be fine with that as well.
Mr. Chairman, thank you so much
thank
for your
you.
Time and your testimony. Mr. Wilson, do we have anyone else on 2019?
Mr. Chair, no. We have no one else on 2019, no one else on 3295 or 3344. We have a number of people on 3480 and 3343.
Very good. Would you go ahead and call?
We have a couple more people for House Bill 3480, Trish Smith and Bill Kluting.
Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a public sector and private sector union representing 20,000 educational employees, also working in parks and recreation districts and libraries. And I'm here to, I signed up on one of the bills, but I actually would like to talk about the issue generally and a couple of the bills in specific. I'm handing out to you a sheet that the Education Coalition has put together on the issue of capital construction needs for schools. The first thing I'd like to tell you is, as many of you know, school districts, whether they are in high growth areas or declining areas, virtually all have serious capital needs. And we believe that the legislature can assist school districts in any of those circumstances with a variety of tools that school districts need in their toolbox. Some of the bills before you are ideas that we hope are included in the toolbox with some minor modifications. House Bill 2019 is a school impact fee, as you have heard. OSEA supports the concept of a school impact fee. We, however, do not support the provisions of 2019, which couple the school impact fee with the parks fee. We don't see that that's necessary. We don't think it's appropriate. It would be very difficult to administer. And it would have a tendency, we believe, to put a damper on needed parks construction and needed school construction and make it much more difficult for parks agencies as well as school districts to implement the impact fees that they need. We think they should be separate as all other SDCs are separate, and we think an impact fee is better than an SDC for schools because school districts would then have the ability to enact it themselves rather than having to go to another government and ask permission and ask that other government to enact it. So that's how we feel about 2019. Take out that second part, and we're fine with it. Our coalition also supports looking at land use laws relating to school capacity. We have identified in our sheet House Senate Bill 336 as a mechanism to use. It's not yet in your house. We hope it gets here. General obligation bonds. Still, K-12 school districts do not have access to state authorized general obligation bonds. H.J.R. 13 just dipped out of the Senate or the House Revenue Committee, I think, this last week. That would authorize, that would go to the voters, and if the voters approved, would authorize the legislature to issue GO bonds for K-12 districts. We think that would be very helpful to those districts that don't have a property tax base that would allow them to go out and get a whole bond all by themselves. And then a bill that, or House Bill 3480 deals with a capital sub-capital matching account. There are too many words in there. Matching sub-account, whatever. In any case, this is an account that is currently empty, attached to the Education Stability Fund. We do support the concept that you see in House Bill 3480, although we believe that this should be a one-time seed allocation from the excess lottery revenue that we worked so hard to generate through the reduction in retailer fees in the last couple of years. We think, I think that I've heard the number of $20 million if you use this as a one-time allocation. We think that would be great seed money in that capital sub-account, and we know that that account is projected to get additional revenue in the 2009-11 biennium. So House Bill 3480, if it were amended to take that money from the lottery one time, but not all the time, we would support that. And finally, we appreciate very much the House passing H.J.R. 14 over to the Senate, which will go to the voters and ask them to revise the double majority law, which we also believe is an important component to allow school districts to help themselves in their capital needs. And we think that that toolbox, if you will, that array of tools in a toolbox would allow school districts, whether they be high-growth districts or declining districts, to look at their capital needs and have some mechanism that they may use to help address them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. Committee for the record on bill including Carpenters Industrial Councils affiliated with Carpenters International. Chair, committee, this year Oregon's going to get ready to embark on $700 million worth of school construction. I represent thousands of members in this state, and our members, as 3480 is written, we are against it. House Bill 3480 is a very, very expensive bill. Briefly, let me explain. Every big construction job has to have engineering firms, and now we have environmentally energy savings construction firms, engineering firms. Nationwide, after fiscal impacts, states and school districts have adopted Green Globes engineering firm, not LEEDS, for construction engineering. LEEDS certification can and has been as high as 10% higher than Green Globes. Now, remember, these two types of certification groups are almost equal as far as environmental and energy saving standards. If we use the 10% overrun, it's simpler to multiply, we're talking $70 million of extra cost added to school construction. $70 million. Green Globe certification is also very comparable, as I spoke. It's also easier to work with. It's more worker-friendly. On the ground friendly. And that helps speed up construction, and that is a very cost saving item if we can get these schools built on time, under budget. And here's the sticker. LEEDS does not recognize Oregon's public or private T timber, lumber products. They have other standards that they use. Chair committee, Oregon has some of the best forest practices in the world. We have some of the best timber in the world. I'm talking public and private. I'm not getting into the federal problem. And we got some of the best workers in the world. But yet our timber products aren't good enough for Leeds. If we take section 2 on page 2, clear out, and amend that to include green globes, our members could possibly okay this 3480. The chair committee, the way it's written today, we are against 3480. Thank you. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Kingham, thank you both very much for your time. And especially we have some more folks there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a few more on House Bill 3343. Peggy Lynch, Don Schellenberg, and Jeff Stone. They can come up, and then we have two more after that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peggy Lynch. I represent the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters of Oregon is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government in order to build better communities statewide. The League has long been a supporter of Oregon's statewide land use planning programs and the 19 goals. The League continues to believe in a statewide program that addresses all of the needs of our communities. Schools certainly fit that description. But removing the need to use the exceptions process established under Statewide Planning Goal 2 for schools and allowing water and sewer services to be extended subverts good planning practices. It also leaves open the pressure on local governments to allow other uses to connect to these services. Local citizens, unclear about our land use system, will be confused about why they cannot also access these new urban services outside UGBs. Of greater concern is whether it makes good sense to locate a school outside the area where most of the students reside. We know that we want elementary students to walk or bike to school whenever possible, and we want to have those schools close to parents to encourage volunteerism. We have noted that high schools that have been located away from populations cause increased stress on our local road systems. Many schools are used for community purposes, health clinics, community centers, public hearings, etc. These are some of the good planning reasons for integrating new schools within our communities. Recently, the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee heard testimony on Senate Bill 20 related to pesticide spraying, which currently can occur in rural areas near schools. There was testimony presented related to spray drift onto some rural school land. Others shared that farmers need to spray to control weeds. And the League isn't taking a position on this particular issue, but one clear point was made at the hearing. There is often a very real conflict between agriculture needs and locating non-agricultural uses on or near that land. This conflict is just one more reason to reject 3343. We ask that instead you work with schools to assure that there is land inside urban growth boundaries available for school facilities. And I'd like to make a couple of other comments really quickly. The League has not taken a position on the capital funding issue related to schools because the League always does its homework first, and it has to have a study, and it has to consult its members related to positions we might take after we have been educated on the particular issue. And it's not an issue that we have focused on. However, we have focused on the need to provide community services, public services for everyone. And that obviously would include schools. So we have testified in another committee on Senate Bill 336 related to schools infrastructure or schools in planning. We also know that we would not approve a parks cap in any kind of funding proposal because the league is very definitely a supporter of our local parks. But I want to point out that these are local decisions, and that's another thing the league can say we believe in. And that's why SECs or school impact fees are appropriate. It's a local decision once the legislature allows it to be a local decision. And they get to balance where, how to fund their various public facilities. So any kind of preemption is something that we don't support either. One last comment, Representative Greenleaf, the issue related to annexation was the fact that the bill was written for a deferral of property tax and not an exemption. And it was the 10-year deferral that seemed to be the issue in that I understood at least. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Buckley, members of the committee, I'm Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. House Bill 3343 proposes to do two things. Override the administrative rule that requires taking an exception to Goal 3 when siting a school in an EFU zone within the 3 miles, and override the prohibition of extending water and sewer services outside an urban growth boundary to service the school. Too many local governments continue to hold the view that an EFU zone is simply a land bank that they can go to and purchase less expensive land whenever they have a need for a park, affordable housing, some public utility, or a school. Understandably, they often see this as an alternative to buying higher-priced land inside the UGB for the desired use. However, less expensive land for urban uses is not the purpose, nor was it intended to be the purpose of the EFU zone. Yes, land values are lower in EFU zones because many non-farm uses are not allowed in EFU zones. Therefore, land price speculation is reduced in EFU zones, and that's by design. This allows farmland to be bought and sold among the agriculture producers at prices that producers can pay for the land from the proceeds of the commodities they sell. They are not supposed to have to compete with government tax dollars to purchase farmland. Allowing local governments to purchase farmland and establish a non-farm use unfairly competes with farmers who would purchase the land for their operation. The purpose of the exception process within 3 miles of UGB is to require the applicant for a non-farm use to conduct an alternative analysis to determine whether or not there is land available, price not being a factor, inside the UGB on which they can be sited. If there are no alternative sites, then it can be sited within the 3 mile limit. If there is a need in the UGB for more land for any use, the proper action is to expand the UGB. Yes, that takes some planning and some time, but it provides for orderly growth, not leapfrog development and conflict with adjoining farm uses. If schools are sited within the 3 mile limit and water and sewer services are extended to service them, there will be huge pressure from everyone along the route between the UGB and the school to convert their land to housing. After all, the lines run right in front of my property. Urban growth boundaries would essentially be null and void. The exception process should not be abandoned as provided in House Bill 3343. Schools were included at the statutory inception of outright permitted non-farm uses in an EFU zone in 1963. The reason they were included is because rural citizens need education services just like everyone else, but they shouldn't have to travel excessive miles to the city to take advantage of those services. If a school is located within 3 miles of the UGB, who does that benefit? Not the rural citizens. It benefits the urban population who take advantage of less expensive land and only have to travel a couple of extra miles for the services. The law should actually be clarified so that schools cannot be sited in EFU zones unless they are operated primarily by and for the rural residents. The Oregon Farm Bureau asks that you refrain from passing House Bill 3343. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Schellenberg, question.
Yeah, you make this compelling case for the sanctuary of exclusive farm use zone, yet these farmers have not only had low land value, they've had property tax exemptions for all the while that keep their their taxes extraordinarily low. And the argument makes a lot of sense, except now under Measure 37, so many of these people, having advantage of that, are saying they want to develop urban uses on their farmland now. How does this sort of sanctuary theory and the fact that there's so many applications from these farmers who hold that land exclusively for the sacred trust of farming now want to build subdivisions?
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, 2 points. I'll take the last question first. The Oregon Farm Bureau does not support waivers as an alternative to financial compensation under Measure 37. So we do not support that concept. We do not support developing farmland. We support keeping farmland in farming in the EFU zones. Secondly, I would offer a correction. Farm use assessment is not a tax exemption. Farm use assessment is not a tax deferral. Farm use assessment is simply using the income approach to determine the value of that land based on its use. And that's the same process that's used for industrial and commercial property. There are no back taxes due. What there is a tax penalty as an encouragement to keep the land in farm use. And that tax penalty makes you think of a tax deferral because it equates to 10 times the difference between the taxes at farm use value and the taxes at market value. So it makes everyone think it's a farm deferral, but it's not a farm deferral. It's a tax penalty as an encouragement to keep land in farm use.
Can I just briefly follow up?
Very briefly, we have other
very briefly.
We
get yeah, to. So the Farm Bureau supports trying to raise the money to pay for those uses if they don't support, obviously, waivers. You must support raising taxes or finding some ways to get the $3 billion or whatever it is to.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, we would support some method of funding. We have not identified a method of funding to do that, but yes, we would support some method of funding.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that brief interlude on Measure 37.
if I might, Don, I might be on the wrong side of the issue, you being more representative of rural than rural Oregon, but when we talk about a sanctuary, when the urban growth boundary is extended, aren't they supposed to be looking for a 20-year supply of school of land?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dahlem, yes, that's correct. When UGBs do expand, I mean, that's the whole purpose of periodic review, is to determine do we have a 20-year buildable supply of land.
And what's included? When we say a 20-year supply of buildable land, does that mean streets and parks and schools and other services that it needs? So is there, where I'm going with this, when we have an urban growth boundary, aren't schools planned for inside of that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dahlem, they should be. I'm not sure that they always are. In fact, we have a bill, House Bill 3462, that does speak to that issue and would require that when the UGB is expanded and they do the planning for it, that when they do make the expansion, they identify what those uses are and those uses are protected for that use and not changed to some other use inside the UGB, and therefore requiring a need to expand the UGB again for the original use that they expanded it for in the first place.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stone. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Stone. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I was going to try, Representative Dahlem, not to out myself that I'm a former chief of staff at Metro, but I can answer a lot of your questions that you just posed.
Thank you.
But let me get through my initial remarks, which are very brief, mercifully, for all of you. We support rural schools. I mean, I want to make that first and foremost. In fact, agriculture, schools, places of worship are the first things that are very basic tenet binding a community, especially in rural, and I would say urban areas as well. The big distinction with this bill is the urban services being extended out into rural communities, and that, for us, is a key distinction. And with all the issues that you're dealing with on land use, which deal with water policy, land use, housing, industrial land, as a total picture, it begins to emerge about rural lands. Rural lands are just not a default. It is a way of life. It's working lands. And we provide a valuable resource that's not only cultural, but economic. The nursery industry in particular, which is your state's largest sector of agriculture, since I've burdened the Ag Committee with this stat, we bring in over $1 billion a year each year. And we use relatively small amounts of land. But if there's any one industry that bridges the urban-rural divide, it's nursery land. So we're sensitive to these type of issues when they come up, and that's why I wanted to make my comments today. So what I would ask is that when you consider bills such as this, that you go forward cautiously, especially when it deals with exceptions. And so then I'm now I've availed myself to answering multiple questions about metro sense.
And we're going to pass on the offer, but I appreciate it very much. Thank you so much for your time. If we have two more witnesses on these bills.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Bob Rindy and Jim Johnson, please.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation Development, and what I've handed in is a joint letter of testimony from DLCD, Department of Land Conservation Development, and Department of Agriculture. It's on our letterhead. That was due to a coin flip. I declined Jim's offer for an arm wrestle on that because we don't have a combined letterhead, but we do both concur on the points made here. This bill would authorize schools outside of urban growth boundaries that will serve an urban population. And in fact, from the way it's written, it almost guarantees that if any schools are sited on the high-value farmland that's allowed for this bill, it's least likely that the houses that those schools will serve will ultimately end up anywhere in the vicinity, because urban growth boundaries can expand to high-value farmland only as a very last resort. So it really has some serious flaws in the way that it's written. I've handed out to you, and I apologize, I don't have enough of these, but my understanding as I left the office is that I can get some more of these, and I can even turn in the one that I'm going to read from here for a minute for you. But what this is a pamphlet put out by the Oregon School Boards Association that is urging public policy to work towards having schools as part of neighborhoods rather than away from neighborhoods. And if you look at this, and I realize it's probably too long for what you're doing today, but the gist of this is that communities began to move away really in the 70s from neighborhood center schools, and as they did so, what we've seen happen is rise in costs, other costs associated with schools, mainly having to do with transportation. And Oregon ranks 26th in the country in school transportation expenditures. We spend an average of $325 per student, and according to recent statistics, this is vastly higher than other states. So the main point to remember if you were to authorize schools on farmland, and Jim's going to talk about the impacts to farming, remember that other costs will go up, perhaps at least as much and maybe more, including costs for the facilities you're going to send out there, the costs for roads, the cost to transport students, and the state, of course, will pick up the tab to bus all the students some distance from the neighborhoods to these schools. But that's a cost that we all pay as well, whether the district does or not. So from a planning standpoint, what we have tried to do over the years is this issue has come to us every session in my memory since 97 when I started working with legislature in the department, is to try to get school siting and school planning in sync and done together with the planning that goes into city planning and urban growth boundary planning. Schools are, of course, allowed to buy land outside of urban growth boundaries, and many do, in anticipation of growth, and that will mean that their costs would be much lower. But right now they can't build an urban school outside until the community gets out there as well, i.e. until the urban growth boundary expands. Last year we amended, after about 2 years of meetings and lots of consideration of different policy options, we amended the rules for urban growth boundaries to make it even easier to expand urban growth boundaries to provide school sites. State law for high growth districts has already, I think, for it's now about 6 years since that was passed, required districts and cities to plan together long-term for expansion of the boundary and the needs, 20-year needs that are there. Not for other districts. That's not to say other districts don't. But it's more and more necessary that the way schools are sited needs to be considered in conjunction with where the community is going to grow. And communities, of course, are always growing in a direction that makes sense from the standpoint of transportation, sewer infrastructure, and a lot of other very expensive public costs. And we should not encourage districts independently to go some distance from the UGB simply for inexpensive land and with no idea whether the community is ever going to go there, or, in fact, encouraging development in a direction that the community probably ought not to grow and probably on its own wouldn't have chosen. So there's for many reasons that we have serious concerns about this bill, and would urge that you take those into consideration as you consider it today. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. We could take your colleague's question or testimony here.
Chair Buckley, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm the Land Use and Water Planning Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Real quickly, what we're dealing here are really two almost opposite types of situations. High-value farmland is where, in most cases, the most intensive agricultural operations occur in terms of all the various agricultural operations that are almost too long a list to talk about. And you're introducing an intensive urban use into an intensive agricultural use. Look at agriculture like an industrial area, and you would question, why would you put a building with hundreds of kids into the middle of an industrial area, in this case an agricultural area, that uses a lot of intensive practices. By taking away the exceptions process, you're taking away any consideration in the siting of a school of alternatives, as Mr. Schellenberg had talked about before, alternatives that would not necessarily impact surrounding agricultural operations, would not use high-value agricultural land, which is, by the way, the best agricultural land of the list of farmland that we protect in this state. High-value agricultural land, by the way, also usually includes, for the most part, when we're talking about food crops, where irrigation is also present. And so we're not only talking about a loss of land base, but also a loss of water base to a non-farm use. As proposed, there's also no real consideration of the impacts to those agricultural operations that I previously discussed. Pesticides use, dust creation by cultivation, odors created by livestock agriculture, traffic, hazards by trespass. It's been our experience that a lot of people from urban areas kind of see agricultural land as open space. So what's the problem with walking out there in those orchards or walking out into those cow pastures and the like? And of course, there are problems. It's an intensive use. Bottom line, getting away from the land value question for a second, because that's been discussed an awful lot, we're really talking about some key compatibility issues. We probably get more complaints of the Department of Agriculture and our pesticides program from perceived or not related to schools and pesticides use, and we believe that the introduction of a school into these types of situations without consideration of alternatives, without considerations of impacts to agriculture, is not good policy.
Thank you very much. Representative Clem.
Are we at the end of our...
We're at the end of our panels. We wrap up here, but you have a quick question.
I did. For Jim, can you outline just briefly some of the other types, separate from schools, some of the other types of allowable things that can happen? Because there's often this sort of notion that nothing can happen on a farm use zone, period. And aren't there something like 38 different ways you can build structures and or other things? Can you rattle through some of them for us?
Chair Buckley, Representative Klein, without going through the whole list, I wish it was only 38. It's upwards and getting to the 70 ballpark range now. The EFU zone initially, when it was adopted, had 5 non-farm uses in it. It seems like over the years, you know, there's been 5 to or more uses added, you know, every other year or such to that. Parks may be allowed under certain circumstances, schools, commercial uses in conjunction with agriculture, several types of housing, model airplane parks. It seems like Mr. Schellenberg talked about, you know, people seeing agricultural land as kind of the holding zone for other uses. That's not far from the truth when you look at the list of uses that are authorized. But a lot of those uses are still subject to review against standards for protecting agriculture. This does not provide any of that type of review.
Was that kind of a last question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real quick question, Bob. Would 3343 create a potential situation for island annexations by cities, do you think?
Well, I don't think so, because I think when a school district buys land, that's generally doesn't by itself indicate that that is part of the city. I can see how it would create pressure for the city to move that direction, either through annexation or other means, but I don't think by itself it creates an island.
I was just wondering, because of the extension of the services out there to the school, and now all of a sudden then there's a right of way that's needed, and then it's,
thank you.
There's a Don, last word. Thank
you, sir. Yes, most interesting day, and this bill particularly, as superintendent of the Central Lynn School District, we would turn the grass seed fields right up close to the, right by this building. We would spray in the fall. The football field was absolutely beautiful. Sprayed it when it needed. Dust and spray were never any problem. But then when I moved to Chenoweth, inside the city of the Dalles, we had to spray for goathead, which the city mandated that we control goathead. But we had to spray Christmas vacation 2 weeks after school was out or 3 weeks before it started. So the issues that have been raised today are monumental. And I don't think you realize when you plant a school, unless it's ag kids going there, they have some comprehension of what that dust is all about or what that smell is. They know that. And if I didn't make that comment, there is a difference. And to intrude into farmland is done with extreme peril to the farming community.
Thank you, Representative. Members, thank you much for your attention. I have tried to get a 10-minute break to represent comp before a 3 o'clock hearing. We got 5 minutes. If you have input on these bills, committee members, please let me know during the coming week. We'll keep our eye on what the Senate is doing as well and figure out how to go forward. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2019, close the work session on House Bill 32, public hearing 2019, close the public hearing on House Bill 3295, close public hearing on 3343, close public hearing on 3344, close public hearing on 3480, and adjourn the committee for today. Thank you.